Thank you, Mr. Williams. Good afternoon to all. A little bit of a rainy day out, off and on. I bring you greetings from several sources. First of all, from my wife, who is still recovering at home from her hip replacement, which is now almost 3 weeks ago. So she's getting a bit more mobile. The first 2 weeks or so, she pretty much wanted to stay upstairs. It was a little harder with the stairs, as you can imagine. We find ourselves asking on occasion, now we bought a two-story colonial after the kids all left home because... And we haven't really come up with a suitable answer for that, except when they all come home again for Thanksgiving or whatever like that. But at any rate, she's doing better. The last couple of days, she's been, I wouldn't say zipping up and down the stairs exactly, but... certainly more trips up and down than she was during the first 2 weeks. So she's making progress, and she looks forward to the day when she's going to be able to be back in services with all of us here. So Mr. Smith very graciously offered to webcast, mostly for her benefit. He said, I need the practice anyway. We need to test this system out. So so far, so good? Okay. So I told my wife, you'll see me before I see you. So that's the way it works out. She's always concerned when I travel to Meadville by myself. She said, you need to take somebody to keep you awake. So I went up to Merle Slagle last Sabbath, and I said, what are you doing next Sabbath? And he just looked at me for a moment. He says, I guess I'm going with you, aren't I? So I picked him up about 7:15 this morning, and he's been riding shotgun today. And my wife left strict instructions, tell Merle to poke you if you look sleepy. So I passed the instructions on. He said, well... Terry, you'll pass the instructions on after I wake up from my nap. So that wasn't particularly helpful, but at any rate. But anyway, she sends her regards. Certainly the members in Meadville send theirs as well. And good to see all of you here this afternoon. Right after we came home from the feast this year, it was hot. Like 85 degrees in early October. You heard a reference to that in the first message from Mr. Pavlik. Even on the day of my wife's hip surgery, which was October the 9th, the temperature reached into the low 80s. It seemed like we'd had a bit of a kickback to the previous season. Of course, about 2 to 3 days later, it plummeted to the 40s and 50s and hasn't done a whole lot more since then. It hasn't recovered too much. But at least it feels and looks, with some color finally showing up in the trees and the leaves, like it is into fall for certain now. And that leads to other thoughts. Mr. Pavlik passed on his thoughts about climbing under or curling up under a warm comforter. I thought that was certainly a good analogy, since comforter means something in terms of a blanket one way and obviously a reference to God's Spirit the other. It's certainly a lot to think about. I don't know about you, but I've been doing a lot of thinking along certain lines on certain themes as we head into what we sometimes think of as the long wait between holy days this fall and winter. And this year it will be a little bit longer than usual, because this current year we're sort of finishing up now on the Hebrew calendar is one of those extra month ones. We have an extra month, a 13th month on the end. And so the holy days next year will be all of them pretty much 3 weeks later than they were this year on the Roman calendar. So we have a little bit longer to wait than we might some other years. This year, as I told my wife in the last couple of days, I have really felt what I think of as a kind of a strong nostalgia for the feast. And it centers around the most recent one we kept, of course. It seems like in our experience of the last several years, there was a time when we would go to the same feast site several years in a row. One stretch, we went 10 years in a row to the same site. But that's changed a lot in recent years, and we've kind of bounced around a bit more, depending on where the needs are for both pastors to be speakers and, in my wife's case, a music coordinator, special music coordinator. But two out of the last three, we've been in the same site, and perhaps it was thinking about that that it seemed so familiar this time around after we'd been the same place 2 years ago, just north of Victoria, British Columbia, in a small town called Sydney. So I got nostalgic about it, and I'm thinking, how could it have gone by so quickly? It was here, we were looking forward to it, we were preparing for it, she was working on her music, I was working on the messages I was supposed to give. There was one glitch this year. This was the first time ever that I went to the feast and I didn't have the messages all finished. That's not a good thing, but they all did get done before they got given, let me put it that way. The message for the last great day was finalized on day 7 of the feast, but at least it was done before the last great day. So that's always helpful, I guess. But when we came home, it was as if, what just happened? Where did it go? We've been home 3.5 weeks. That's pretty much twice as long as we were away. And the time keeps going. And I got to thinking about the admonition that Paul gave us about learning some lessons from ancient Israel. They felt nostalgic for the past too, but not in a good way, as you know. When you look at the example of ancient Israel, they were longing for a worldly past. That's not what I'm feeling, and I suspect not what you feel either as you look back at the feast. I've been feeling so strongly that it was as if we left our home when we left the feast this year to come back in one way to this home. Because it pictures the future for us. It pictures the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. And that millennial reign gives us some idea of what our tasks will be as brand new members of the family of God. And in one sense, that's home. And so it felt so strange to be leaving home and coming back home, if that makes any sense. But one of those sections that Paul mentions that is in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians 10, in verse 1, he says, "Moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink." There's a common experience we have in observing God's holy days. They drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. We have a chance to learn some lessons that apparently the ancient Israelites didn't do very well at. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. We might say, well, I don't have a problem with that. Brethren, we live in a world that has so many distractions. Maybe if we substituted the word distractions, it would help us. That we shouldn't be distracted after the things of the world as they were. It's so easy to get our minds off the things that are the most important of all. And don't become idolaters as were some of them. That certainly deals with the issues we have in our world. It's so easy to have other things take over. Mr. Kylo mentioned that last night in the presentation of In Accord that Mr. Patching was referencing. He talked about Stephen Covey's principle of how sometimes the urgent crowds out the important. And that's so true in the world in which we live, isn't it? Maybe we don't think of that as idolatry, but if the things of God get shoved to the back burner, isn't that what it is? Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Well, we might say, well, I'm not going there, but are we being faithful to God? To use that analogy, are we clinging to, Paul even talked in his letters about, he said, hold fast the traditions you've been taught, knowing from whom you've learned them, he said. That's important in our world. We have a reason for the way we do things in the church of God. There's a reason for the way services are conducted. There's a reason for the way we observe the holy days. There's a reason for the patterns we have. And we have nearly 100 years of modern church history to look back on to have learned some lessons about what works in keeping our eyes focused and what is not helpful. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them complained, were destroyed by the destroyer. Mr. Pavlik's message can help with that. You know, we can get caught up in our difficulties, and we can easily get to complaining. We had a, a very feisty lady in the very first church I ever served in Winnipeg, Manitoba, clear back in the mid-70s. She was a Scotswoman. She was from Scotland. That doesn't mean she drank Scotch all the time. She was from Scotland originally, and she was just a real straight shooter. If you asked her how she was doing, she didn't believe in prevaricating or pulling the punches. She'd say, "Rotten, thanks, how are you?" So, well, she had some things to work on. One time I visited her in the hospital, and her cane was moved around to the other side of the room where she couldn't reach it. I said, "What happened to your cane?" She said, "The nurses took it away." I said, "Why?" "I don't know." So I went and checked with the nurses. They said, "Well, if we got too close, she grabbed hold of the end of it with the foot and used it and would hook us and pull us over to her bed." So I went back in. I said, "Now, Mrs. So-and-so," I said, "the nurses told me." "Well, okay then." But you know, through it all, she maintained a certain sense of humor. And we all loved her for it, even though, like I said, she was just a real straight shooter. She, I'm sure, is no longer with us. She was in her mid-80s. 45 years ago, that'd make her about 130 now, and I just don't think that happens anymore. But what about us? Do we complain, or do we see the value in what we're learning, as you heard in the first message? Now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. I think about those verses. Verse 6 pretty much said the same thing. These things became our examples. It comes to mind. And I also thought, maybe because of the connection in 1 Corinthians here, if you go down to verse 13, where God has a promise for us, he says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will make the way of escape that you might be able to bear it." I thought about Christ's temptation. You know, the temptation in the wilderness, the 40 days and 40 nights of fasting, followed by the test by Satan. And there are some connections there too, when you stop and think about it, and how he put up with Satan's efforts for a time. But he would always defeat them by turning to what? By turning to God's word. Satan would try to twist God's word, and Jesus Christ would correct it. And he would straighten it out, and he would apply it properly instead of twisting it to try to accomplish some end that Satan had in mind. Christ would say, "That's not what it means. It's also written, 'You shall not tempt the Lord your God,'" for example. There are a lot of things we can learn. You heard in the first message, and there's a certain element of that in this one, we've come home from the feast. We were home at the feast. We've come home from the feast. And sometimes some of the challenges that we were facing before we left are still here. They didn't go anywhere while we were gone. But this verse in chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians in verse 13 tells us God has something in mind he'll help us with. James chapter 1, there's another point to keep in mind. The big picture. Today's maybe the message is about big pictures. I don't know. But we didn't talk about them beforehand. There wasn't any collusion. We just both came up with separate messages today. James chapter 1 and verse 12. "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he's tempted, 'I'm tempted by God.' For God can't be tempted by evil." It doesn't do anything. It doesn't make him want to try it. "Nor does he himself tempt anyone. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed." And then there's a step-by-step progression here. When desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's full-grown, brings forth death. "Don't be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. And it comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation or shadow of turning." I've puzzled about that expression sometimes. The only thing I can come up with in my mind is that no matter how bright a light is, we are physical and mortal and we'll cast a shadow. But it's as if God's so bright, there's not even any shadow. It's just an amazing concept. "Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. We're sort of the beta test. Jesus Christ, of course, was the first of the first fruits, and his efforts were successful. He has returned to join his Father, beside his Father, in the third heaven, now awaits his Father's signal to return to make the plan go forward some more. These verses ought to be encouraging to us, brethren. What does it mean to you and to me in our lives right now? Well, I was kind of mulling over some of that. Then I was wandering through a section of the book of Deuteronomy not so long ago, and I stumbled on a rather amazing section. Let's start in Deuteronomy chapter 8. It always surprises me when I find verses where I don't think they ought to be. Ever have that happen to you? Now, I'm not like the one Bible translator, James Moffat, who, when he had that problem, he just started shifting them around. He'd move them here and move them there and move them some other place. If you've ever tried to use the Moffat translation, which is, it's much older, and I don't know that it's even in print anymore. We don't hear too much about it anymore. But he would shift stuff around. He'd put it over here, and he'd put it over there and move it different places. I'm not so sure that's a good idea. In fact, I am sure it's not a good idea. But in Deuteronomy chapter 8, it begins here. But that's kind of getting ahead of my story for just a minute. Do you know what I found? Sometimes buried deep within the details that seem less relevant, there are some surprising passages, and they catch you by surprise. Passages that we need to think about and say, why is it here? I found one of those sections a while back. I know it's been there all along, but somehow it seemed as if I just found it and it just popped up in front of my face. Maybe that's what's so interesting at its core about God's Word. But keep your place here in Deuteronomy. We'll come back to it. But in the letter to the Galatians, Paul talks about certain things. The letter to the Galatians is an interesting one. It's a book that puzzles many well-meaning people, some who consider themselves Christian. But they use it so often to teach that somehow the law of God isn't the same thing as the law of Christ. They'll try to say, well, the law of Christ is much more loving and much more kind and much more, you know, it's about love, 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 love. And they claim that trying to keep the old law is legalism, trying to earn salvation by your works. Well, that's sad, because in misunderstanding they lose so much meaning for their lives now. In chapter 5 of the book of Galatians, Paul just gives a kind of a summary. He said, look, let's cut to the chase. Let's see what the difference is. In verse 16 of Galatians 5, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. He says, get your priorities straight, and things will fall into place. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. They're contrary to one another. You cannot do, or you do not do, the things that you wish. He was an expert on that. Read Romans 7 again. But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. That is, the law's penalty is exacted on those who break it. The law's penalty is death. Now, the works of the flesh, he says, this is typical of a fleshly approach. They're evident. They're obvious. Adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. That's a pretty complete list. Of which I told you beforehand, just as I told you in time past, those who practice those things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Practice. Is it possible for Christians to slip, be deeply sorrowful and repentant, and ask God's forgiveness and go on? Well, of course it is. But, he says, if you're looking for a pattern, here's the contrasting pattern. The fruit of the Spirit, and he lists 9 qualities with which we should all be familiar. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. There's no law against any of these, in effect, he says. And those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, then let us walk in the Spirit. Let's not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. From that, he goes on to something very interesting in chapter 6. He says, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, in other words, here's somebody who is caught in it. That's one possible translation for overtaken. You who are spiritual, restore him in a spirit of gentleness. That does tie in to the message we heard first today. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens. Can that include providing comfort? You bet it can. And so fulfill the law of Christ. Huh, interesting. Law of Christ. But it talks about trespasses and sins. Apparently the law of Christ has concerns about sin and trespasses too, just like the law of God. Maybe it's because they're the same law. If anyone thinks himself to be something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For each one shall bear his own load. There's a way in which we can lighten others' loads and provide help and comfort and encouragement. But there's also a way, brethren, that in the end we are each responsible for our own lives and the choices and the resultant consequences we make. And so he goes on in verse 6, let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. It's been said some people like to sow their wild oats and then pray for a crop failure. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Mr. Slagle and I were talking about several things in the car today. We spent like 4.5 hours plus there talking, and he was napping most of the time, but other than that, actually he wasn't. He was keeping me awake. But what he told me is partly confidential because he was telling me about some things he was thinking about for sermonettes in the future. And if I say them now, then they will, you know, I'll be in trouble afterwards. So let us grow, not grow weary. We'll reap if we don't lose heart. It's important, brethren, to carry through to the finish. We can think of examples in the Bible of people who started well and then it didn't end well. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. God does make a difference with those he's working with now. He said, they're special to me now. They will, all my children will be special to me in the time that is right for them. Cause and effect, choices and consequences. Make good choices. The consequences are bound to be better. He goes on to finish about, he says, some of them were just missing the point. See with what large letters I've written to you with my own hand. As many as desire to make a good showing in the flesh, these would compel you to be circumcised, only that they might not suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. There were some who didn't understand the decision that had been made by the council in Acts 15. Not even those who are circumcised keep the law, but they desire to you, have you circumcised, they might boast in your flesh. But God forbid that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. He talks about in Christ Jesus, you know, that past, that distinction, nothing, that doesn't avail anything but a new creation. For as many as walk according to this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. There's an interesting phrase. The Israel of God. There's a way in which Israel will still have a chance to fulfill its original purpose. As a model to other nations. Do you know when that chance will be? In the beginning years of the millennial reign of Christ. They'll have a chance then, those who are the descendants of ancient Israel, and those who have joined with them and have become part of the nations of Israel will have the chance to set the model for other nations. Zechariah 8 talks about that. I won't turn there now. Some, though, who back in the day that Paul wrote Galatians, didn't understand certain things, and there are some who don't understand it now, what he was talking about. Paul's purpose wasn't in discussing whether God's law should be kept or not, but he was talking about whether that's how God pronounces us righteous in his eyes. That's called justification. Is that the purpose of the law, to forgive sin? No. The purpose of the law is to identify sin, to show us what it is so we avoid it. There's another process entirely that's involved in God's forgiveness, and that involves the sacrifice of his son. But that interesting phrase, the Israel of God, clearly it's the New Testament church Paul's talking about. Clearly. That cycles back to those verses in 1 Corinthians 10. So now at this point, let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy, because there are some surprising verses there that look like they should have been written by Paul. And yet here they are, clear back here in the Pentateuch. Remember the connection with Christ's temptation, how he was tempted by Satan? Remember how he was able to quote scripture, a lot of it, from these earliest books of the Bible, and point out that it had a timeless message. In Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 1, we read these words, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." You know, Jesus Christ in his day ran into all kinds of issues with people. Again, keep your place here in Deuteronomy for a moment and take a look at his debate going back and forth with some of the Pharisees in John chapter 6. They didn't understand what he was talking about. He references the ancient Israelites. There is a connection here. John 6:31. He says to them, to the Pharisees, "Our fathers ate the manna in the desert. As it is written," well, the Pharisees quote this to them, to him, "Our fathers ate the manna in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." And then Jesus said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses didn't give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven." He said, that was only a type. The manna back in ancient Israel, you don't even understand what it pointed to. The bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. They said, "Well, Lord, give us this bread always." It's like the Samaritan woman at the well saying, "Where's that water? I don't want to have to keep coming to the well every day." Jesus said, "I am the bread of life." They didn't get it. "He who comes to me shall never hunger. He who believes in me shall never thirst." You drop down to verse 41 after his pronouncement and explanation. They still don't get it. The Jews then complained about him. You know, I am sure that the Jewish community, the religious community of the day, was really disappointed in Jesus Christ. I'm sure that they were really frustrated by him, because if he was who some were saying he was, if he was the Messiah, then why wasn't he out messiahing and removing the Roman yoke? Wasn't that what the Messiah was supposed to do? Throw off the yoke and sort of establish something like Israel under Solomon again? They couldn't think big enough, and they didn't see the point. The Jews complained because he said, "I'm the bread which came down from heaven." They said, "Wait a minute. Isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he say, 'I've come down from heaven'?" Jesus said, "Don't murmur among yourselves." And then look at this famous verse in the context. "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day." Do you and I understand what that means? How many times have you tried to explain to family and friends your beliefs? How's that working out for you? If God doesn't perform a miracle, it can't happen. They didn't get it back then, but I hope we do. Verse 47 says, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life." That's the goal. That's the plan. That's where we're headed. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness. They're dead. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I'm the living bread which came down from heaven. If you eat it, you'll live forever. And he talks about his upcoming sacrifice of himself, the fact that he would give his life in payment for sins for all humans. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 8, remembering the connection about trials and about suffering that you've already heard about today. Let's think about that old instruction, those first three verses we already read. So he humbled you, Deuteronomy 8:3, allowed you to hunger, and he fed you with manna. They went through some stuff first, and then they were comforted. Verse 4, he reminds them of certain things. Your garments didn't wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For he is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, vines, fig trees, pomegranates, olive oil, honey, a land in which you'll eat bread without scarcity, in which you'll lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. Beware that you don't forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you've eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart's lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness, in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions, and a thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you, there's that word again, and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Think of the spiritual analogies for our lives now, brethren, as you read through those verses. Moses takes the entire next chapter and some of the following one, chapter 10, to remind the Israelites of some of their rebellious times, and there were plenty. We can skip over that for now, so long as we remember that there could be some spiritual analogies for us even in that. I'd strongly suggest that sometime before the spring holiday season of 2019, you make a study of this area with that thought in mind. And we come to what I've found to be this strange section in the middle of Deuteronomy that doesn't belong here, except that it does. It's in chapter 10 and in verse 12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? And I got to thinking about those things as we came home from the feast. What is it that I learned this year at the feast? It was, you know, we've done it a few times now. For me personally, this was my 58th Feast of Tabernacles. That adds up a little bit. I know that I don't look 58, but you're saying, no, you look a lot older than that. But anyway, where do the years go? But do we learn something every year? What does he require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to love him, to serve him with all your heart and all your soul? It just was such a strong feeling this year. It was like it was this wrenching feeling of we're leaving our home. How can we leave our home to go home? This is what it's all about. This is the future. And to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. Heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God. David knew that. Remember Psalm 8? Read it sometime. The Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them, And he chose their descendants after them, you above all peoples as it is this day. And here's this verse that doesn't belong here. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart. That's a New Testament thought. We just read it in Galatians. And be stiff-necked no longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow. He loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore you love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God, and you shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast. And you'll take oaths in his name. He is your praise. And he is your God. Excuse me. Who has done for you these great and awesome things which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons. And now he has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. Verse 11 was kind of the entry verse into the promised land. Arise, begin your journey before the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. What does that mean to us? Where are we? What kind of a journey are we on? Do these verses in Deuteronomy 10 that somehow strangely echo more the New Testament than the Old, do they speak to us? Is our journey to God's family, to His kingdom? Is that what it's all about? Is that why we keep looking forward year after year after year after year to the feasts? I thought of some of the people I've known in the past. And I thought of certain ones who, unbeknownst to them, at some point in time, kept their last Feast of Tabernacles. Because they died in the ensuing year before the next one, sometimes unexpectedly. But that's not where it stops, is it? That's not where it stops. Because realistically, at some point, we will all keep our last feast, won't we? I mean, that's the way these things work. I thought of a friend I know of who is facing some serious terminal cancer in another area, another state, and how maybe this was the last feast in that person's life, perhaps. Thought about that. Prayed about that. Ask God for courage. What kind of a journey are we on? Have we ever even temporarily turned aside from the path of God like the ancient Israelites? Paul did say, you're supposed to learn a lesson from them. They had the opportunity to do all these things. Look at all these words we've been reading. God laid this out for them, and he would have been delighted had they taken him up on the opportunity. He would have backed them up. If they had followed him, the blessings chapter would have been applicable, not the cursings part of it. What about you? What about me? Have we ever taken our eyes off the cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night? There's a danger in that. Have we ever allowed the peoples of the land to turn our affections away from God and his ways? Do we think, oh, you know, well, that particular pagan holiday is just so cute. Really? I don't think so. Not in God's eyes. You know, if you watched In Accord this week, Mr. Patchinger referenced it in the announcements, you heard Mr. Kylo gave a very impassioned plea to make good use of an amazing resource, as he says, we have at our fingertips. And he also made mention of something that rang a bell with me. He said, when I was a teenager, he said, I remember, I took the old correspondence course. Yeah, so did my brother and me. We didn't realize that it was supposed to be for adults. We just liked the idea of, we wanted to do it. So I was 11 and my brother was 9, and we decided to send away for the correspondence course. And somewhere at home, I still have all the old lessons buried, and I still have all my handwritten notes from the time I was 11 years old. Brethren, those things were a gold mine in learning God's way. And his point was, we have the same opportunities now. It's there. Will we take advantage of it, no matter what our ages are? One of the keys he pointed out was to use it as a spiritual tool to fight against getting wrapped up in the cares of this world. He talked about being given to the cares of God and not getting wrapped up in the cares of this world. So this section in Deuteronomy is for us too. Think hard and long about verse 12. Israel, Remember Paul's reference, you are the Israel of God. What does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. You ever think about how perfect his ways are? You ever think about the holy days and analyze them and say, I'm not looking for a loose brick, but there isn't one anyway. I'm not looking for a fault or a flaw, and it's a good thing because I'd be looking for a very long time and never finding it. It's perfect. Micah chapter 6 has another one of those strange verses in the wrong place. I speak facetiously, I hope you know. Micah 6 and verse 6 in the Old Testament. With what shall I come before the Eternal and bow myself before the High God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Did God just have a special desire to smell barbecue all the time? Is that what it was about? That's not what it was about. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? No. 10,000 rivers of oil? No. And then this verges into what the pagan peoples of the land were doing. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Pagan nations did that repeatedly. I was reading in another section about one pagan king who was failing in battle, so he brings his firstborn son out and kills him on the wall so that the battle will go well. What kind of mind does that take? What kind of God do they think they worship? He has shown you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Where does that verse belong? In here. That's where it belongs. This section is for us too. That whole thing bears an uncanny resemblance to Matthew 23:23 and the weightier matters of the law. Are we connecting the dots in that way? Do we connect the dots from those verses we read in Deuteronomy chapter 10 that seem so oddly placed in one way and yet perfectly placed in another? Verse 13 said, to keep the commandments and his statutes which I command you for your good. It reads oddly like some of the things John wrote in his first letter. Why does God command anything that he does? Does he just like to be bossy? Does he just like to remind everybody who's in charge? Does he like a title? No. No. He wants us to do this for our own good. Verse 15, the Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them. I thought of Luke 12:32. Fear not, little flock. It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And I thought of 1 Corinthians 1:26 about our calling. Not many noble, not many mighty, and so on and so forth. So many sections through here sound like the New Testament. Verse 19 says, love the stranger because you were strangers. That sounded like Galatians 6 verses 9 and 10, didn't it? About as you have opportunity, do good to all. And then he said, especially the household of faith. How do we treat others? Are we a sterling example of God's way to all we come in contact with? How will they remember it in the second resurrection when their time to understand is given to them? We want them to look back and say, I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. There was something different about those people, something good different. Good different. We must never forget, brethren, verses 21 and 22 from Deuteronomy 10. He is your praise, and he is your God who has done for you these great and awesome things which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons, and now he's made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. It's a little flock now, but Paul told the Ephesian church that they were part of a larger building, part of a larger purpose. They were being built together over the years, along with those God had worked with before and that he will yet work with in the future. Do we list the great and awesome things he's done for us sometimes? Think about it. We're entering a period where there's no annual holy day on the horizon for a while. There is one holy day every week, though. That's why we're here, isn't it? Hopefully it will serve to point out something very important. A different kind of a sermon today, perhaps more of a stream of consciousness. A reminder of some of the words we read. Jesus Christ himself quoted to Satan. He said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word from the mouth of God." We saw in Deuteronomy 8:3 where Christ said, inspired Moses to write, "He humbled you, he allowed you to hunger, and he fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know man shall not live by bread alone." That's where Christ quoted it from. "But lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." Let's think about some of those random thoughts that are not so random after all as we head into this long wait between the holy day seasons. Keep focused. We don't have the pattern right in front of us for a few more months yet to reenact it again, all over again. But be thinking of the pattern. Long wait, though it may be, I assure you, sooner or later, we're going to feel another set of God's marvelous holy days starting to sneak up on us. And pretty soon you're going to start to hear announcements saying, you know, it's only 6 weeks till Passover. And it'll come again. I don't know about you, but personally,